Okay, well, hello and welcome to episode 36 of Making a Killing, the podcast from Hudson Institute's Kleptocracy Initiative on how corruption is reshaping global politics and security. I'm Nate Sibley, and joining me, as always, but for the first time in a few episodes, I think, are my co-hosts Paul Massaro and Casey Michelle. And today we're going to be looking again at the situation in Ukraine and what that tells us about the threat of transnational corruption and kleptocracy, and whether measures to address those and to take on Putin's kleptocracy can help Ukraine in its hour of need. So, Paul, I wonder if you wanted to kick us off. Just because I've been seeing you, not only you, but also lots of our friends in Ukraine, Daria and Elena, from, for example, from the Anti-Corruption Action Center, desperately imploring Western governments to start going after Putin's wallets. What is one of Putin's wallets, and why would going after them, why are the Ukrainians so keen for us to do that at the moment?
So let me just say, Nate, these methods are not only about solving the crisis, finding a solution to this Putin-created crisis right now, but in fact, this whole thing has been caused by long-term kleptocracy, by long-term strategic corruption, by, you know, Putin's wallets in the West are a lack of resolve in going after them, a feeling of impunity with Putin, a feeling of a trend of kind of mutual, incremental, in-kind escalation where, you know, Putin does something and we sort of respond, and Putin does something, we sort of respond. And we've never been able to get ahead of this by saying, okay, well, enough's enough. Like, we're gonna actually just say, you can't have your blood money, your oligarchs, your gas, whatever, in our societies any longer. If you're going to act like this, then you can't, you know, we can't do business with you. Which was, you know, that is the appropriate response. So I guess when you see where the Ukrainians are coming from, the most important thing to understand is that the Ukrainians have been at war for 8 years. That for us, for the Westerners, it's suddenly a big issue. It's on the news, whatever. But for the Ukrainians, it's another day in paradise. After 2014, when Putin seized and occupied Crimea, Ukrainian territory, destabilized the Donbass, Luhansk and Donetsk, and has continued to do so, and has continued to destabilize these areas for 8 years, has continued with cyber attacks, has continued with strategic corruption, has continued with assassinations, has continued with all sort of covert operations, and so on and so forth. So that's why it's time to get these guys out. It's time to finally say, okay, well, this is another escalation, which, again, is the trend of Putin. He escalated last April as well, you know, and then de-escalated. Because the whole thing for Putin is a matter of escalating, de-escalating, getting in the news, scaring everybody so the sanctions don't come on, going back down, whatever. Now, this time, it's very scary because he may have gone out over his skis. This is always the problem with allowing these autocracies, these kleptocracies, these end state kleptocracies to act like this, is that they may get out beyond where they can go back. And that's what's very scary about this particular instance. But this is not the first time we've seen this. And for Ukraine, it's been 8 years. So I totally get it. I am very supportive of it. It's time to close this down. It's time to finally get ahead of Putin, say enough's enough, you're called on your bluff, you're not going to have access, your regime is not going to have access to our system any longer.
Yeah, I was going to say, Paul, I think you make great point. Just to reinforce it, it has been 8 years since the initial incursion, initial invasion, initial occupation of Ukrainian territory by Russian forces in southern Ukraine and Crimea, then obviously in part of eastern Ukraine, in Donetsk and Luhansk as well. So when we're talking about this newest front of Russian aggression, it is not an invasion, it is an expanded invasion. It is a renewed thrust of an already existing invasion and occupation in Ukraine. I don't know, Paul, you just mentioned, you touched on some of the potential solutions moving forward. I know, Nate, you asked that as well. You know, This kind of happens, excuse me, you know, when we see this renewed aggression in Ukraine, you'll have all these folks coming from outside of the region, outside of certainly our broader kleptocratic space, kind of parachuting in and offering their two cents without any kind of broader context, without any kind of broader grounding in some of the regional dynamics, regional realities. One of those is specifically within our space as it pertains to sanctioning specific Russian oligarchs. Now, obviously, we've talked about targeted sanctions, specific sanctions in the past as a useful tool. Obviously, Paul, you and I have written on this for magazines like Foreign Policy as a key counter-kleptocracy tool in terms of uprooting kleptocracy Democratic networks. One of the things I've seen over the past few weeks is all of a sudden this framing of these targeted sanctions as the be-all and end-all of Western response. Why is it that folks like us think that specific targeted sanctions can pressure the regime, can be the only tool that we have in our arsenal? Aren't there other things we should consider? Why is this something that we think is actually useful in the first place? There's a nugget of truth within that. I don't think any of us are arguing that this is the only thing that can and should be done, that this is the only tool the West should pursue is specific targeted sanctions. But Paul, as you and I know, and Nate, obviously as you know as well, this is one of the key tools that not only we should pursue in the future, but we've already seen the successes of thus far. We see the lengths to which regimes, including those like in Moscow, go to make sure that programs like the Magnitsky or the Global Magnitsky Act are not expanded or effectively unwound. Excuse me, we know how, on the other side of that, how low cost these actually are, right? This is not a lot of overhead to target specific Russian actors, specific Russian oligarchs. There's a great quote from, another counter-kleptocracy expert, Oliver Bullough, in one of his write-ups yesterday. I just wanted to read. He said, quote, "We shouldn't be thinking about sanctioning kleptocrats' businesses solely as a pressure point, but as an already bad thing to shut down anyway. After all, we don't target organized criminals only when they commit acts of violence, but all the time." So to those who think that this is the only tool we should be pursuing, or maybe this is something that is past its due date or something that doesn't have any actual effect on the ground, I would say just look at the responses we've seen from those oligarchic figures, look at what it costs us, which is very, very little, and look at the fact that this should have already been done years and years ago, and we don't have to wait for any further violence for this.
So that's exactly right, Casey, and I guess that's the point I feel like we have to hammer home here, is this is not past its due date. It is long overdue. It should have been done in 2008. The moment that Putin revealed his true face, that all the hopes, because remember throughout the early 2000s, there was hope Putin was a reformer, restabilizing the Russian economy, that this was going to be kind of like this is finally bringing Russia into the fold, you know? But then as soon as that changed, as soon as the infamous Munich speech and then the invasion of Georgia, we should have known. What the heck are we doing? You know, and now it's 2022, and this is the logical conclusion to the approach that we've taken to Russia, which is to say we have allowed the kleptocracy to fester. We have allowed it to take root in our systems. We have allowed our enablers, at least in the United States and the UK, professional classes to become reliant and very rich from Russians. In Germany, businesses to become very rich, former officials to become very rich and reliant upon the Russians. So at this point, this is the only way it was going to go. Now Putin is emboldened. Now Putin has enjoyed so much impunity, you know, why not? Why not do this?
You can't spell impunity without Putin, I'll tell you that much.
Hey!
So, you know, the Ukraine situation is kind of all-encompassing. Everyone's got to have a sort of opinion on it, working in the DC policy space, or anyone on Twitter, apparently. And you know, there's a lot of, I don't want to use the term misinformation or disinformation, but people who maybe haven't like followed this issue. And how does kleptocracy, there are sort of these sort of fallacies you're seeing floating around, particularly, you know, pertaining to the role maybe of targeted sanctions and, you know, them being maybe the only thing that will work. But Casey, do you want to sort of talk about some of those sort of things that you've been picking up? Things that maybe we could use a bit more clarity on before we sort of launch into further conversation later on.
Yeah, sure, Nate. I mean, obviously, I think the biggest fallacy that I'm sure you guys have seen, because it's been almost impossible to miss, whether you're on social media, certainly whether you're watching news or not, is this idea that the latest security threat posture out of Russia is only or even primarily about Ukrainian membership in NATO. That the only thing that this hinges on is whether or not Ukraine becomes a member of NATO or not. And that if that question was simply solved, if we had a better idea whether or not Ukraine was going to be in NATO or not, obviously, ideally for Putin that it wouldn't be, that this whole issue would just kind of magically disappear and things could go back to some kind of status quo ante, before this most recent morass or even before 2014. I'm sorry, that is an absolute fallacy through and through. This issue is not about Ukrainian membership in NATO. It's not solely about that. It's not even primarily about that. There are so many other factors that are so much more important. Yes, it has played a role. Yes, it can play a role. But I want to disabuse everybody listening of the idea that if you come to some kind of grand bargain, grand solution, you know, Finlandize Ukraine, make it a neutral country, that this issue would go away. Because maybe folks don't remember, in 2014, when Russia initially launched the invasion, Ukraine was a neutral country. It was not constitutionally mandated as it is now to become a member of NATO. I mean, I do want to say that I'm not surprised that Ukrainians want to join NATO now. A majority of Ukrainians want to join NATO. Just so happens that that's what happens after a foreign country invades and claims to annex and then occupy swaths of your territory. But again, that is one of the biggest fallacies right now. This is far bigger. This is far more than just Ukrainian membership in NATO and then Russia's position on that.
If anything, it's demonstrated the absolute necessity of joining NATO.
Yeah.
Now every country with fear of Russian aggression must join NATO. It turns out the only way you're safe is if you're in NATO. Yeah. I mean, I would go a step further and say it's not at all about NATO. I see this primarily as about Putin's kleptocratic system, about maintaining Putin's kleptocratic rule. And Ukraine poses a threat to that in the form of just being a prosperous democracy with a Western orientation and a possibly, completing its anti-corruption reforms, completing its rule of law reforms, completing its democratic reforms, and so on and so forth. And then you have the Russian people who look over and say, well, if the Ukrainians can do this, why can't we? Why do we need this kind of kleptocratic strongman?
Yeah, exactly. It's about Putin's desire to, I will say I would highly recommend folks read through Putin's, it's 7,000 words, this incredibly long screed he went on published last year claiming Russians and Ukrainians are one people, a single whole. I mean, there's all this kind of neo-imperialist, colonialist garbage.
The redeemer of historic Russia.
Exactly. That Ukraine is part and parcel of the broader Russian body politic. So it's not just about security. It's also about economics. It's about the kind of patronal or neo-patronal kleptocratic, thuggish model that the Ukrainians booted out in 2014. Team when they kicked Viktor Yanukovych out of office. It's all of these different ingredients that this man who's been living and working and steering the Kremlin for now 20 plus years, who, as we know, the longer dictators remain in power, the more isolated they become, the more paranoid they become, now sees this somehow, these economic reforms taking place, these security reforms taking place in Ukraine as some kind of great threat to his rule. And I think, as you mentioned, Paul, though, he does know full well that if folks see Ukraine succeed, as they have seen, they will get ideas of their own.
And let's just be very, very clear. Ukraine poses only a threat to the continued rule and sustainability of Putin's kleptocratic system, which has been good for absolutely precisely zero Russians, except for him, the handful of billionaires, and the Soloviki security services. Otherwise, nobody has prospered under Ukraine's rule. In fact, it's got the highest wealth inequality in the world. There are no millionaires in Russia, just billionaires.
One of the things, to bring this back to what we were talking about earlier, Paul, in terms of the targeted sanctions, you mentioned a moment ago, and those who are profiting, you know, the reason that we've seen this troop buildup right now, one of the reasons, again, has nothing to do with any, you know, renewed questions about NATO, but it has to do with the fact that the Ukrainian government recently sanctioned Ukrainian oligarch Viktor Medvedchuk, who is close to Putin. He's Putin's daughter's godfather. Again, this wasn't the Americans sanctioning Medvedchuk. This was the Ukrainian government taking it upon themselves. Obviously, we have seen the response from that. We have seen this threat of the greatest land war Europe has seen in nearly a century because of all of these different factors. I would say only one of which is Ukrainian membership in NATO. But again, so much more. All of it tied back to these kind of kleptocratic governance structures and systems we talked about.
And I can't believe I have to say this, but I really feel like we have to because of the way that, I mean, America kind of exposing the Kremlin's plans has actually been pretty effective, I think, throughout this crisis, and keeping sort of an eye on Putin, keeping attention on him so that he can't pull a fast one has been effective. So let's go ahead and just say the Ukrainian military poses no threat to Russia, Russian security or whatever at all. Ukraine poses no threat to Russia at all. Ukraine is not committing a genocide. Absolutely absurd notion now. That Putin is trying to say Ukraine is committing a genocide. I mean, it's like it's gone into such a world of absurdity that, like, you know, you still need to say, okay, this is absurd, but it's so beyond the pale.
I was going to say, you know, Paul, so this brought a question of the role of kleptocracy in and kleptocratic governance structures and systems in destabilizing the region, in pushing Putin to make these decisions, to mass hundreds of thousands of Russian troops now along the Ukrainian border. You know, I wrote about this in another article just a few days ago. You know, I'm perfectly happy arguing that the expansion of NATO in the last 30 years has been an unmitigated good. I don't see nearly enough counterfactuals about what would have happened if NATO hadn't expanded, hadn't happened. But There is a but, there is a caveat. There is still a Western role and responsibility in the broader destabilization, not only of Ukraine itself, but again, the broader region itself, and then leading us to where we are right now. You know, just a few years ago, I was in the small town of Cheyenne, Wyoming, looking at a house that housed all of the shell companies that allowed a former Ukrainian prime minister to move hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars out of Ukraine. You'll go down to Washington, D.C. That's where the home of Paul Manafort, this kind of the greatest American lobbyist to date, who put effectively Viktor Yanukovych in power. And then obviously we saw everything that fell apart from that. Obviously go over to the UK, billions and billions of pounds linked to post-Soviet elites, many of them from Ukraine and Russia, currently in the British economy. You know, the Cambridge Studies, Ukrainian Studies, Cambridge University Ukrainian Studies Department, named for Dmitry Firtash, Putin's primary ally, awaiting extradition to the United States because he donated all these millions of pounds to Cambridge. I mean, it's just case study after case study about the role and relationship of Western financial systems in creating and incentivizing these kleptocratic networks. Thankfully, finally, things are beginning to turn around.
You know, the West is not blameless, but NATO expansion is great.
Exactly.
That's not the problem. Mm-hmm. The problem is bringing all of that blood money and kleptocrats to the West. That is the problem. The problem is that we have effectively, because we've offered this financial opacity, because we've offered these enablers, because we've offered endless capital markets and real estate and, you know, outlets for that wealth, we have enabled the looting of these states ad infinitum. Basically, at a level that's unprecedented in human history. So, yes, there is plenty to blame. There's plenty to fix. But NATO? No. NATO's wonderful. NATO should keep on doing what it's doing. Love NATO.
I'm going to pick up on some thoughts about NATO in a minute. But I just wanted to sort of, just while we're on this issue of international exposure, you know, the extent to which, you know, the Russian quote-unquote oligarchs or the Putin's inner circle, what do you want to call it? You know, is exposed around the world. Is that still what it used to be? And I'm thinking in the sense that, you know, these calls for targeted sanctions against Putin's inner circle, specifically in the Ukraine context, this is, you know, you have some people, I don't want to put words in people's mouths, but I've seen people like sort of Bill Browder saying, this is the thing, right? Like, you know, you target Putin's oligarchs, it will cause dissent in his camp. He'll have to be looking over his shoulder. He'll be sort of, he won't be able to, you know, invade Ukraine, and is sort of the basis of his regime will collapse. And, you know, it's not clear to me that that's maybe still the case in the way it was even sort of 10 years ago. If you think about the way Putin's domestic sort of rule has evolved, you know, in his early years, he was balancing these hugely internationally exposed big oligarchs, people like Abramovich or Deripaska and so on, trying to sort of contain their power, which he sort of did through a series of political maneuverings, murders, you know, whatever it took. And, you know, you had the rise of, Paul, you mentioned earlier, the Siloviki, the sort of more, maybe they came up more, maybe more through the security apparatus, personally loyal, perhaps, in whatever that means in Putin's regime to Putin, and, you know, share his sort of, you know, his nationalist ideology, his revanchist foreign policy. And they're maybe not quite as exposed internationally as those sort of big swinging oligarchs used to be. And, you know, you've had calls, you know, the Russian government itself, as part of Putin's sort of what we now know as a sort of war-proofing of the economy generally, really encouraged, you know, I think they had the gall to say as a matter of patriotism, but encouraged oligarchs with assets overseas to bring them back to Russia. And so that did happen. I'm sure that didn't happen to a great extent because there's a reason they didn't want their assets in Russia in the first place. And so, you know, are these sort of targeted sanctions still going to be effective? And the good argument maybe against that is that Putin will have thought about that, right? He knows full well about the Magnitsky Act, the Global Magnitsky Act, because it's the first thing he tells his diplomats to bring up with Americans whenever they're meeting them. Please get rid of this in exchange for anything. So he knows about this. He knows it's going to be almost certainly part of any package of sanctions imposed against Russia, along with, you know, sectoral things against or things against the financial institutions, whatever. And he's factored that in, and he's sort of thought to himself, well, you know, whatever dissent this causes in my power base, I can weather this. Just to sort of finish, you know, I think the sort of maybe a bit of evidence, further evidence in support of that was this sort of Moscow Times article, which was really good a couple of weeks ago, just where the reporter went around and spoke off record to some of the wealthiest businessmen in Russia, people you would expect to have, certainly in America or something, a seat at the table with people in relevant government departments and some influence over what happens through lobbying or whatever. Obviously, the system works very differently in Russia. And they were sort of petrified because they do keep, they said, you know, a decent chunk of their money overseas, but they do not feel they have any influence over what is going on in terms of Putin's actions towards Ukraine. So it's not popular amongst, you know, quote unquote, the broader oligarchy, I guess, but they don't feel they have the power to affect foreign policy. Maybe that falls outside, you know, the deal of what they're able to talk to Putin about. Sorry to go on for a bit, but what do you guys think about that argument?
I'll jump in with a couple quick responses, Nate. Obviously, you know, great points throughout, and there's still all of these questions about the relationship of sanctions, either targeted or sectoral or broad or what have you, and the kind of resultant behavioral change or the resultant realities on the ground. It's you know, it's obviously a difficult thing to disentangle correlation and causation. But there's a couple quick responses I wanted to get through. One, we should do it because it's the right thing to do. It's the moral thing to do. These are men, almost all of them being men, who are drenched in blood money, who made their billions through illicit activity, whatever that may be, especially in the 1990s and the 2000s, if we're talking about the broader post-Soviet space. These are not legitimate businessmen. These are not entrepreneurs. These are parasites that have grown fat on the wealth that should have been directed elsewhere, that are effectively desiccating these countries and obviously leading to the broader destabilization right now. That's the first reason that we should do it. The second is they're all low cost in terms of these targeted sanctions. All we have to do is put the names of these figures on the, whether it's Magnitsky, Global Magnitsky, it doesn't cost us anything. It's cost thing are the PR representatives, the shell company operators, the financiers that are working with these oligarchs that are profiting from, again, all of that illicit wealth that these oligarchs made through their years. There's a third element of this that we do this in a whole, I mean, I say we, the United States of America, but in addition to other Western jurisdictions, a whole range of other countries without any thought of behavioral change. We do this in Uzbekistan, we do this in Kyrgyzstan, we've done this in Latvia, we've done this in Bulgaria among American allies, not with any behavioral change, but again, because it is a means and a mechanism of some kind of response to their malign activities. And again, Paul, you and I have written about this in the past, of disrupting these kleptocratic networks. It's another wonderful tool for that when those local populations don't have any other means of getting back or hitting back against those figures themselves. And the last thing I wanted to say is, you know, targeted sanctions are one of the greatest soft power developments the U.S. and the broader West has developed in the last decade. These oligarchs, you know, the support for them is paper thin, whether it's at home or abroad. There is no, they're not a political party. They are not some kind of cultural icons. These are people, these are figures, and again, often men, that folks on the ground, the populations back home, realize are effective organized criminals, are effective foot soldiers of a mafia state ruling them. And that all of a sudden, here comes the United States of America coming in and saying, what they're doing is wrong, and we're going to block access to Western financial systems and as many other financial systems as we can. Boy, what a boost to American soft power at the end of the day.
So I just want to, you know, endorse everything Casey said, because to me, that's enough. You know, you don't need anything more than that to do them, because we're protecting ourselves. It's enhanced our national security. It's justice. You know, it's normative power. These guys shouldn't be here to begin with. You know, there's so many extremely good reasons to do it beyond whether it actually topples the Putin regime, right? So let me focus on kind of that last little bit. I mean, if you sent all these guys back, they would be a political force. Like, I mean, would they be more powerful than the Soloviki? Maybe. I mean, they were in the 90s. You know, I mean, Putin has asked for some of the wealth to come back, but it would be a completely different scenario if suddenly Abramovich had to live in Russia. You know, if suddenly Deripaska had to live in Russia. Like, I mean, if suddenly all these oligarchs all at once, you'd have to do it all at once. And this is one of the things that we've kind of goofed at sanctions-wise, is we've incremental mutual escalation. We hit one person, we do this, we warn you about SWIFT so you can make yourself more resistant to SWIFT. If we keep on just doing like, okay, we're gonna hit Sechen, okay. Months later, we hit Kostin, whatever. Everybody prepares, right? They move everything around. If you did it all at once, you hit all the Navalny 35, you hit everybody at once, then they're like, oh my God, like they mean it. Like we need a new system, you know? And yeah, they'll be up against a lot over there. And maybe they don't win, but maybe they do. And in all honesty, it's worth the shot because we need to do it anyway. So it's like, it's all like icing on the cake, right? It's like, exactly, we have to do it anyway. And it might end the Russian kleptocracy.
No, and you know, it might not distract Putin. I should have made clear, I was somewhat playing devil's advocate earlier, though I do think, you know, a sanctioning the oligarchs will not immediately stop Putin's tanks rolling into Ukraine if that's what he's set on doing right now, because it will take a little knock on, you know, time for those things we're talking about to happen. But you're right. You're exactly right, Paul. And the other thing I think that's important to remember is it will distract him somewhat, and those distractions will grow as people's problems grow as they get sanctioned. So, like, you know, even if his cell phone ringing off the hook with all his, you know, oligarchic friends isn't enough to stop him invading Ukraine, when they all come back with their suitcases, their stuff full of cash, and they're angry, and they meet all these people who are still in Russia, who are angry but don't feel empowered enough to do it, perhaps you are creating a new mix there in Russia, as you say. The other thing is it sets a sort of looking more broadly. It sets an example for other countries that might want to invade smaller neighbors. So, you know, I'm thinking of particularly, of course, of China. If China invades Taiwan, you know, they need to know that the US has the power to slap personal sanctions on, you know, members of the Politburo.
Yeah.
Which won't worry them because all their assets are in China. It's not perhaps the same model as Russia, but their kids and their families, you know, are often overseas getting educated. They often keep their money offshore, not necessarily in the US. I think they'd be pretty stupid to do that at this point. Although we've seen like the amount of wealthy, you know, Chinese businessmen who are party connected who keep their money in South Dakota trusts, all the rest of it. So I think, you know, a really concerted campaign to personally target, you know, the assets of these regimes at the top, also sets a precedent for something we could do in the event of a Chinese invasion of Taiwan.
Without a doubt, and if I could just add, I mean, it's, you know, pre Navalny, still at the time of Nemtsov, so there's kind of like, you know, of course Nemtsov has now been assassinated by the Kremlin, and Navalny's been jailed, but these are kind of the Russian opposition. But I mean, the great kind of threat to Putin that came around was Khodorkovsky. You know, and the whole, like, you know, taming of the oligarchs where he jails them and he kind of says, okay, but the deal here made, okay, is that the oligarchs that do what Putin says and then they get to live abroad. So they don't get political power at home, but they get to have all this stuff and they get to live abroad and they get to live, you know, in the West and they don't really have to be under the system, right? So in some sense, you are destroying the political economy, you are breaking the political economy of Russia, of the kleptocratic system of Russia. I shouldn't call it of Russia, but I should call it the Kremlin, right? Because the Russian people have nothing to do with the political economy of Russia beyond being looted, right? But the political economy of the Kremlin system, when you say, okay, well, now actually the oligarchs have to live under Putin, then suddenly, you know, you may get the rise of another Khodorkovsky.
I was going to say, I wanted to actually read one quote from another professor. I know I read Oliver's quote earlier, but this is from a professor at the University of Toronto, Seva Gunitsky, who's, if folks don't follow him on Twitter, he's one of the best follows out there, one of the most salient follows. He had this great thread the other day talking about it at more of a kind of theoretical political economic model and the relationship between wealth and democracy. And as he said, quote, in general, and again, this is just kind of surveying the literature, not particular to Russia in itself, but surveying the broader literature, the relationship with domestic finance and democracy. He said, quote, in general, if you force the wealthy to park their money inside the country, they care more about what happens in it. And a lot of what we call democracy started because elites were worried about the monarch taking their stuff. I think, Paul, this gestures at what you were just talking about the relationship between Putin and the oligarchs, what we've seen in the past, the current arrangement, and what we may potentially see in the future. You are bringing more stakeholders into the stability of the Russian government, into the future of Russian governance writ large. God knows I'm not going to be the one to defend any of these oligarchs, but in terms of the broader theoretical construct for why it is important to shove that money back into Russia proper, to shove those actors, shove those networks back into Russia proper, cut off that Western security valve for them, make them have that much more stake, that much more incentive to push back, to call out, to organize, what have you, whatever it may be, to make sure that they actually have a stake in this broader Russian stability and eventually Russian democracy, that is just icing on the cake for all these other reasons that we've already laid out about specific targeted sanctions.
Right. I think I quote tweeted that exact tweet, Casey. And I mean, it's you know, it's something I've advocated for a very long time. And I think it's very true. I mean, I think that's how the rule of law arises to begin with, you know? So, I mean, I think it's very, the big indication that that's the case is the way that Putin and his government are always, as you say, Nate, extremely scared of Magnitsky, extremely scared of targeted sanctions on oligarchs and stuff like that, and make this big scene about them. I think they understand that if you actually sent the oligarchs back, there'd be trouble. And they want to prevent that at all costs.
No, totally. And so we're coming sort of, not right quite at the end of time, but we're getting there. And something just popped back into my head. We were talking about NATO earlier. One of our big sort of policy ideas. We've not sort of fleshed out in a massive way, but at Hudson Institute, or the Kleptocracy Initiative specifically, is about, you know, integrating some of the anti-corruption, anti-kleptocracy measures that we talk about so routinely into NATO's sort of readiness sort of structure, the things that NATO countries are expected to have and certain standards they're supposed to uphold as part of their membership. Now, we obviously do that. You know, if you, whenever I've tried to talk to people that I sort of move with at Hudson Institute, you know, sort of foreign policy, national security minded people, they'll say, no, NATO is and must be narrowly construed as a military alliance. But then, I think it was in 2016, we suddenly saw NATO members came together and added a cyber component to the traditional, you know, kind of post Second World Cold War thing of like, how do you get tanks across bridges in Eastern Europe? Suddenly, NATO is able to work together, and is expected to have NATO members, countries are expected to have standards of being able to work together on cyber. And that makes sense, because that's a new form of warfare in the 21st century. And so do you think, guys, think the time has come maybe to move beyond NATO's building integrity program, which is all to do with, you know, how NATO countries provide security assistance when they're in theater, so in Afghanistan, for example, but looking at their own, you know, financial defenses to, you know, Russian money, because we've seen how it's hampered NATO's united response to the Ukraine crisis. Germany's behavior, for example, it's very clear that there are influential people in Germany who don't want Germany to take a strident position on this because they have a financial interest. But that conversation is being and same with France, which, because its banking sector is so exposed, to any conflict with Russia. But the same conversation is presumably happening all across the city of London right now. What do you guys think about, you know, is it time for NATO to add a counter-kleptocracy component?
So I would say to that, Nate, obviously a great question in and of itself. You know, NATO has existed as a security alliance since the late 1940s. As you mentioned, much of that exists within the kind of actual hard military theater as a security component. We saw in 2016, now 6 years ago, the addition of cyber and elements of cybersecurity toolkits and best practices and information sharing. Obviously, NATO extends into things like nuclear security as well. All of these different components within the broader field of national security concerns. Obviously, in this case, international, transnational, because it's a multilateral security alliance. I guess what I'm saying is, Nate, what we saw just last year was the Biden administration elevate corruption to a core national security threat, placing it on par with military, nuclear, terrorist, cyber, other elements of core national security threats. It elevated corruption to the highest rungs, the highest echelons of national security concerns. I don't see how we can't add counter-kleptocracy and anti-corruption toolkits, information sharing, partnerships, innovation, information sharing, et cetera, all of that into the broader NATO portfolio. I don't see at this point how we can avoid that, because the U.S., which is one of the primary prongs of the NATO Security Alliance, has elevated it to a core national security threat. That is the way the direction is going. I would certainly argue that it is past time for NATO to incorporate that into its broader portfolio itself.
So, yeah, I mean, maybe. I think it's harder, and certainly the DoD is not, you know, I mean, understands the threats that come through finance, but is not construed, you know, finance as a domain of warfare. And as they have cyber, right? I mean, in some sense, like, it started at the national level, and maybe it will go that way. But I mean, you know, even when you look at where our sanctions take place, it's not DOD, right? I mean, and where our law enforcement takes place, it's not DOD, and it probably shouldn't be. You know, it's law enforcement. It's banking. I mean, the other thing is, when you look at like the international architecture that exists for these issues. OECD, Anti-Bribery Convention, FATF, a ton of different treaties on anti-corruption. Like, I mean, I think that there is a way forward beyond NATO. And I think it would, in fact, work better beyond. Like, I always like talk about an economic NATO, a different organ, like an economic coercion against one is an economic coercion against all. You know, that's the kind of thing I might want to see. Maybe that exists parallel to NATO. What was it? the North Atlantic Transparency Organization, you know. But it's just
that's a good one.
You know. I do think we have to give it some really deep thought, because it is like when we start saying like, okay, we need to see this as a domain of warfare. I mean, that makes sense because it obviously is, and it is the domain of warfare for China, right? It's the one they use more than anything, you know. But I guess I just wonder what that ultimately looks like. And I mean, NATO clearly has a role to play, but I don't know if it's parallel to like an OECD with teeth. Like, I mean, remember, the OECD started as the organization as our basically economic cooperation organization to fight the Cold War, right? I mean, it started as a way to disperse Marshall aid, Marshall Plan aid, you know, and eventually grew into something different. Maybe it's OECD, maybe it's something different. Because we also need to be thinking like this gets into like a way broader conversation of what do we do about the fact that a lot of the international organizations that have been created to facilitate economic trade and finance are now corrupted from within, mm-hmm. And can no longer do their jobs. And I mean, I even think about FATF giving, you know, Rosfin Monitoring, the FIU of the Financial Intelligence Unit of Russia, a very clean bill of health. Right. Good job, guys. You know, like what the heck, you know, the WTO, I mean, basically can't function. You know, I wonder if the move is more creating organizations that overlay that, that are democratic organizations and exist parallel to NATO. I've kind of thought of this sometimes as like a triangle. Like you need a military component, which is NATO, which maybe even goes global. I was thinking about like a North Atlantic, South Pacific treaty organization, a NATO, a judicial piece, because you need that kind of you need cross-border legal cooperation more than ever, as we all know. And then, you know, some kind of economic integration piece. And maybe it's a trade agreement. We've had a trade agreement with the European Union in the works for a bajillion years. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, I don't know what it ends up being, but I guess that's okay. That's a long-winded response.
For the first time, I think it was with Mexico, a recent trade agreement included for the first time ever in U.S. history, apparently, an anti-corruption component.
Right, right.
Which was really good when I read it. You could just drop, you could copy paste that into all our trade agreements.
USMCA. That's right. Yeah. You know, and that was actually taken from TPP, yeah. Mm-hmm. Which TPP, of course, didn't end up happening with the United States in it. But I just, when we think about the architecture, the kind of international architecture of the 21st century. Mm. I mean, I really think that we are in the building phase. I mean, we are basically in, I know there's like some organization in town called New Bretton Woods, but I mean, an actual, like how do we rebuild a liberal architecture that does not necessarily include kleptocracies? And it can overlay an internet. You don't have to get rid of the UN and the WTO and so on and so forth, but it can overlay that. And then we can kind of speak more strongly with one voice and do like a two-speed kind of thing. Mm-hmm. 'Cause that's what it's going to take to purge this money from our system.
And I was going to say, just to circle back to what we were talking about earlier, this is where Ukraine fits in, because Ukraine is at the very front line of this broader discussion, this broader fight of the 21st century, of democracy on the one hand and corrupt kleptocratic authoritarianism on the other. This is where the fate of so much to come will be decided in Ukraine.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
Which is why now is such a terrifying and optimistic and remarkable and historic inflection point.
Well, there we go. I think we've probably run out of time for today. So thank you both for all your insights. Thank you for listening. I should have said at the start, this is being recorded on Thursday, the 17th of February. So obviously there have been sort of developments even overnight, increased sort of shelling along the Ukrainian border. As always, for the past three weeks or so, the situation could change rapidly. I should have said that at the start, really, because it sort of colours everything we talk about. But thank you for listening, and we will be back next week.
Thanks, guys.
See you later.
Making a Killing is produced by Phil Hegseth and kindly supported by the Kleptocracy Initiative's parent organisation, Hudson Institute. I hope you enjoyed today's episode. If so, please subscribe and share with your friends. And if you have time, please consider giving us a 5-star review on Apple or wherever it is you get your podcasts, as it really helps get the word out. That's all from us. We'll be back next time.